KFC, it's finger-licking good. For a limited time at participating KFCs, prices may vary. Tax extra.
The Republican health care plan, a major topic on the Sunday talk shows. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price making the rounds. Correspondent Chris Barnes recaps what he said.
Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, among many administration officials on the Sunday news shows, talking up the Republican health care plan.
Because it allows for every single person to get the access to the kind of coverage that they want.
Price speaks on NBC's Meet the Press, but Republican Senator Susan Collins says that bill in its present form probably won't even be considered by the Senate.
The House bill is not going to come before us. The Senate is starting from scratch.
I'm Chris Barnes.
Three people under arrest following new clashes over the removal of Confederate monuments in New Orleans. Hundreds of demonstrators took to the streets yesterday, but police say the protests were mostly peaceful, if they were a little loud. However, a scuffle broke out near the Confederate Robert E. Lee Memorial, causing officers to take three people into custody, facing charges of disturbing the peace. This is USA Radio News.
Hi, I'm Wayne Allen Root, and I take care of my own health. That's why I subscribe to Life Extension Magazine. And now you could do the same for free. Life Extension Magazine is the ultimate source for health. Every issue is jam-packed with the latest therapies and innovative treatment protocols. And now you could take charge of your own health. My listeners could get a free 6-month subscription to Life Extension Magazine. Just call toll-free 855-870-6622. That's 855-870-6622. Or go to lifeextension.com/war.
A vigil now being set up in front of a California high school after a bizarre incident left a teenager dead at the hands of San Diego police. Here's Jason Campidonia.
Dozens of people have been placing flowers, cards, and candles outside Torrey Pines High School. Students will be back in class today after their classmate was shot by San Diego police officers. Officials say the teen called 911 on himself around 3:30 in the morning Saturday, but refused to drop his BB gun he had pointed at the cops. The investigation is ongoing, and there are now activist groups calling for the officer's body camera footage to be released. I'm Jason Campidonia, San Diego.
One of our European correspondents who's been tracking the French election says despite a massive loss in the presidential election, the populist theology of Marine Le Pen isn't going away. Here's Ollie Barrett.
Emmanuel Macron has shown that centrist politics can still win, but be wary of predictions that what happened here in France heralds the end of populist electoral victories. Even here in France, Marine Le Pen's anti-immigration, anti-globalization manifesto pulled in 11 million votes. She made it to the second round runoff. She says she is now the genuine opposition here, not either of the two traditionally mainstream parties. Ollie Barrett, Paris.
A man accused of killing a father of five with a single punch is now in custody. The Las Vegas Review-Journal reports police have arrested James Beach a week after he punched a 45-year-old man in a bar. USA Radio News.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good morning, Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HunterdonChamberRadio.com.
Weather this afternoon, partly sunny with a high near 59. Northwest wind around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly patchy frost after 5 a.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a low around 35. West wind around 6 miles per hour, becoming calm in the evening. Patchy tomorrow, patchy frost before 9 a.m. Otherwise, partly sunny with a high near 61. Northwest wind 3 to 6 miles per hour. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 38. Calm wind. Wednesday, mostly sunny with a high near 65, north wind around 6 miles per hour. Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a low around 44.
Good afternoon and welcome to Mental Health Matters. I'm Larry Cartwright, your host, and our co-host is Tracy Ivey, who just read the weather. And this is NAMI's hour, compliments at the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and there is a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we're all volunteers. We have no office, no paid staff. We work out of our houses, and as someone once told me, at least you don't have a traffic jam getting from the kitchen to the dining room. But we try to help people who either have someone in their family or know someone or work with someone who has a mental health issue. And we do this in various ways. We do it by teaching classes called, one class is called a family-to-family class, which is a 12-week class for families or someone who knows someone or work with someone who has a mental illness. And they touch on various subjects. And the ultimate goal of the class is to try to get the person to realize what it's like to be the person who has a mental illness. And we do it through medications, side effects of medications, etc., what to say, what not to say in certain circumstances, what to do, what not to do in certain circumstances, and overall to try to help that family or person understand more what the other person is going through. We also run support groups. They're held at the third Thursday of every month in Flemington at 52 East Main Street from 7 to 9 o'clock. And everything said in the support group is confidential. And we have what they call a basic class for people who have families or family member or children who are 18 or under and have mental health issues. It could be anything from, you name it, you know, ADHD to whatever. And that's a 7-week course. And everything we do in NAMI is free. There is no charge. We don't charge you for the pamphlets or the paperwork or anything like that. If you need more information or you'd like to get questions answered, you can reach out to us at 908-284-0500. That's 908-284-0500. And we don't man the phone 24/7, but we do have someone that checks it twice a day, and we promise you we will get back to you. Today we're very privileged to have with us Robin Marks, who is the Senior Community Relations Addiction Specialist at Princeton House Behavioral Health. And we're also very privileged to have with us Dr. Mindy Parisi Cummings. Did I say that right?
Yes.
All right. And Dr. Cummings is a licensed psychologist with nearly 20 years of expertise in eating disorders. And Dr. Cummings serves as a program director for the Center of Eating Disorders Care at the University Medical Center of Princeton, as well as administrative director of hospital psychiatry. She has held faculty appointments at Chestnut Hill College, Immaculata University, and the College of New Jersey. In addition, she has written and presented extensively on assessment and treatment of eating disorders, as well as the impact of eating disorders on families. Dr. Parisi Cummings earned her Master's of Science in Education from the University of Pennsylvania and a doctoral degree from Fordham University. Welcome to both of you. I have a privilege having you here today.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Thank you for having me.
Doctor, you're at the eating disorder unit at the University Medical Center. Is that different than where Robin is at the Behavioral Health? Is it in the same building, just a second part, or what?
It's a different building. Both Princeton House and University Medical Center of Princeton are part of Princeton Healthcare System.
Okay.
The eating disorders program is located in the hospital because okay. our patients tend to have some significant medical complications. So we're okay. located in the medical center itself. Princeton House is
a freestanding
right.
behavioral okay. health hospital.
All right, Robin. Would you explain to people who are not familiar with Princeton House what it is and who it centers on?
Absolutely.
And
of
how it got started.
Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Robin Marks, and I represent Princeton House Behavioral Health. We are the behavioral health arm of the University Medical Center of Princeton. So we're a freestanding psychiatric facility for both behavioral and addiction disorders. And we also have 5 outpatient sites. So it's a full continuum of care. If somebody needs to be inpatient for stabilization, we can do that. That is in Princeton, and it's a 45-year-old facility. Now, it came to be because long ago, the medical center, which just being a med-surg facility, had a behavioral health unit and was looking for another piece of property. And a woman named Kitty Carlisle, for those who might remember, What's My Line?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she had purchased this property to make it a facility for those in the entertainment industry for their twilight years, let's say. Well, she was a very good actress, but not a very good business person. And so when she was approached by Princeton Healthcare System to purchase the land, she gladly gave it up. So it's a very well designed building in that it feels very spacious, and it goes out to different wings, so you never feel like there's a lot of people. Typically, our units are about 15 people per okay. unit, so we make it small and intimate and staff it then accordingly. And we've been there for 45 years now.
That's awesome. Now, you said there's five locations. Is that five locations throughout the state, or...
Five locations for the outpatient, because as the change of the insurance policies happened, and it really hospital is just for stabilization.
Right.
So although we're a multifaceted facility in terms of therapies we utilize, sometimes a person is at a fragile state and they're not at a place where they can incorporate everything we want to teach
right.
them. So it just by evolution, then we had outpatients that would kind of catch them on the out when they leave, so they go into partial hospitalization program. So they're not inpatient, you know, mm-hmm. they get to go home at night, but they're still being able to be monitored by a physician, a psychiatrist, a nurse, they have a social worker, therapist, and then as they become more solid in their recovery from whatever got them in the hospital, then they step down again to an IOP, PHP IOP.
Intensive outpatient
program.
Right.
Thank you. I'm so used to using the letters.
Yeah, acronyms are great.
Yeah, exactly. So really a full continuum of care could be 7-10 days in the hospital, 2 weeks, partial hospitalization program, and maybe another 6 weeks intensive outpatient program. So with that amount of care, what the therapy and what they're being taught
right.
hopefully is so integrated that then they can step down to just seeing their therapist maybe once
mm-hmm.
a week, twice a week.
Okay.
Or maybe have a NAMI support group in there.
Right, right. Okay. All right, Dr. Parisi Cummins, your turn. Why don't you tell us exactly what is an eating disorder?
Okay. Well, an eating disorder, there are a few different types of eating disorders. So when we talk about eating disorders, we may be talking about anorexia nervosa, we may be talking about bulimia nervosa, we may be talking about binge eating disorder, and there are other eating disorders as well.
I know binge eating. You want to explain the other two?
Okay. So anorexia nervosa is a potentially life-threatening disorder that's characterized by, really the hallmark of anorexia nervosa is weight that's too low for that particular individual. So
okay.
That might be weight loss that occurs through restricting one's food intake. It may be weight loss that occurs through excessive exercise. It may be weight loss through purging types of behaviors, things like self-inducing vomiting,
mm-hmm.
laxative use, things like that, or some combination of all of those behaviors. It may also not involve weight loss, but rather a failure to gain weight in younger folks as they should be growing and gaining weight. Sometimes in a younger person, they don't lose weight, but they don't gain weight as they're growing,
right,
so that
right.
still results in a weight that's too low for what would it be expected for them given their age and height and body build, etc.
I know when we give a monthly presentation at Educational Services, and one of the PowerPoints that we show is a young man who he was 23, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He weighed 89 pounds,
mm-hmm.
and he died one night in the middle of his 1,000 sit-ups.
Wow, okay.
And, you know, and people say, well, why didn't his mother realize? Well, you know, he's 23, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like his mom is watching him all night long and everything, you know.
Sure.
But, you know, it's just sad, mm-hmm. you know, it really is. Because, Absolutely. You know, that's a life cut short, and who knows where it could have went, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you raise a good point. I mean, that's really the point is eating disorders are potentially life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
You asked about bulimia nervosa as well. Bulimia nervosa involves cycles of binge eating or eating what most people would consider an abnormally large amount of food at one sitting, accompanied by a sense of lack of control over one's eating during that time, followed by some kind of compensatory behavior that the individual engages in to prevent weight gain. So that might be things like self-inducing vomiting or laxative use, or it might be alternating periods of binging with periods of restricting or over-exercise.
I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
How young do you see this? In what age can it begin?
It can begin really early. At the Center for Eating Disorders Care at Princeton, we take kids as young as 8. So we have seen eating disorders in kids that young. I have... you know, been aware of eating disorders. We don't treat patients younger than that, but I have been aware of eating disorders in patients even younger than age 8. So it's a big range. We see it in children, and we can see eating disorders in older patients as well. You know, there's really no upper limit on age when it comes to eating disorders.
It's amazing. 3, 4, 6, 8 years old.
Yeah.
You know, it just boggles my mind. It really does. I just, you know, can't grasp someone that young mm-hmm. having that much of a problem, you know, or why, you know. Now, is eating disorder the same in male and female, or is it different? Or, you know, are there common eating disorders for male as opposed to yeah. females, or...
Well, eating disorders have historically kind of been thought of as disorders that affect women as opposed to males. But we know that males can and do have eating disorders. You just mentioned a young man who unfortunately died as a result of his eating disorder. And the picture that you presented is not atypical at all. You know, weight mm-hmm. loss, excessive exercising, particularly for a male patient. So previously, males were estimated to be about 5 to 10% of the population of individuals with eating disorders, particularly anorexia and bulimia nervosa. But more recent data suggests that it's more like 25%, approximately 25% of eating disorders patients are male, and maybe even higher than that, because I don't know that we have the full picture. I don't know that the prevalence numbers really capture the full universe of people who have eating disorders, since that may not capture, for example, subclinical eating disorders or you know, people whose behaviors don't rise to the level of a formal diagnosis but still have clinically significant behaviors. They may experience high levels of disordered eating, even though it's not doesn't mm-hmm. meet all of the diagnostic mm-hmm. criteria per se. So we suspect it's much higher than what's been historically reported.
Go ahead.
A question. Are these disorders primarily biologically based or mentally based? What would you say?
You know, historically, throughout the ages that we've been, at least that we've been kind of talking about eating disorders in the professional literature, there's been a real tension between descriptions of eating disorders as physiological illnesses or psychological or behavioral illnesses, and it's right. it's kind of gone back and forth. You know, it's really kind of both. I think it's very clear that there's a strong biological component to the illness, and one that, just a really biologically mediated type of illness where there's a genetic component or there are maybe some personality traits that may kind of create a vulnerability to developing an eating disorder. But then there are environmental factors that are likely at work as well. As a field, I don't think we have a full picture of the cause of eating disorders, but... I've heard it phrased on a number of occasions, genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger, and that's probably the best mm-hmm. way of thinking about it.
Right. You know, in this presentation that I've just mentioned, we also show a picture, and it's a young lady, and she is probably, maybe she's 70 pounds if she's an ounce, and skinny as a rail, but she's looking in a mirror, and she sees this overdeveloped, pudgy type person. And do they visually see themselves as being heavy like that? And this, the one in the picture was not heavy. She was just, you know, a lot heavier than the one that was looking at her, you know. And I just curious, you know, when they see themselves in a mirror, do they see themselves as being overly overweight?
For anorexia nervosa in particular, distortions in the way and problems in the way one's body is experienced is another one of the diagnostic features of anorexia nervosa. So we see body image distortion quite a bit, where people perceive themselves to be much larger than they are in actuality. Or there's a sense of denial or lack of recognition of the seriousness of the low weight that they're at. So that definitely goes along with the diagnosis, where people don't even necessarily see that there's a problem.
Do you, in your opinion, feel that eating disorders coincide with mental illness?
There's a lot of comorbidities, or even multi-morbidities, I would say, with a number of illnesses. We see a lot of anxiety disorders in folks who have anorexia nervosa in particular, particularly things like social anxiety, generalized anxiety, obsessive. We see a lot of obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
There seems to be quite a bit of overlap in terms of the symptom picture there. Some substance use disorders. There's a good amount of overlap with substance use disorders, mood disorders, bipolar disorder in particular, with overlap with bulimia nervosa. Again, substance use disorders tend to overlap quite a bit with bulimia nervosa. So, yes, a lot of psychiatric or behavioral diagnoses, as well as a lot of physical complications.
Mm-hmm. When, I don't know how to ask this, someone, male or female, doesn't matter, how do they come about choosing this type of process, for lack of a better word, that they do? I don't understand.
So how do they come?
How do they come about to, you know, either binge eating or then throwing up or whatever they do to get rid of it?
I think one thing that's important is that I don't think that it's a choice so much. I think people sometimes will embark on dieting, for example, as part of maybe I'm going to, you know, I want to get healthier, or I feel like I have a little bit of weight I want to lose, and they start dieting. So dieting is often the trigger, and then that dieting kind of takes on a life of its own, and it becomes, you know, just an avenue to be pursued in and of itself. But I don't think it's a choice so much as something that kind of takes over the individual's thought process, much like somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder and obsessive thought kind of takes over. They wouldn't necessarily choose to engage in like hand washing over and over again, but they're obsessed with this idea, my hands are dirty, I have to wash them to clean them. And I think you see a process similar to that in eating disorders.
Okay, it's just, you know, it's just so traumatic for, I would imagine, the family of
Absolutely.
Someone who has this, whether it's male or female, it really doesn't matter. And you say you see this in older people also, not only teenagers or young adults. Is it more apt to be between teenagers and young adults than older people? Or
in terms of when it first manifests itself, the kind of average age of onset for people with eating disorders tends to be in early adolescence for anorexia nervosa and later adolescence for bulimia nervosa. So in terms of when the disorders first present themselves, typically they're disorders of adolescence. That's when they emerge. Again, that said, as we talked about earlier, they may emerge much earlier than that. And for some people, it can emerge later on in life. Although I've also seen a number of older individuals who have been struggling with the illness throughout their life. It started in adolescence like others, but for whatever reason, whether they didn't get adequate treatment or it just continued to be, they continue to struggle with a chronic form of the disorder, they continue to have it later on in life.
Okay.
You know, Larry, you brought up something interesting about the whole family, and I'm wondering, are they involved? How involved can they get in the treatment?
I think it's really
especially
critical.
Through Princeton.
Yeah, I think it's critical for families to be involved in treatment. You were mentioning earlier that the families are really impacted by someone in the family having an eating disorder, and that is so true. Families are really devastated by this illness, and you know, oftentimes when we see families coming into treatment, we're not seeing them at their best. You know, they're with their child who, or adolescent, or even adult child, who has a potentially life-threatening disorder. So families are in need of their own support as well. And so I think it's really important to work with not just the individual who has the eating disorder, but the whole family, especially if it's a child or adolescent. I can't imagine working with a child or adolescent without working with the family as well. And we really stress that at Princeton. We expect that the families are involved at least twice a week for family therapy with their loved one, as well as a multifamily program that we have on the weekends. But even for our older individuals with eating disorders, we aim to have as much family involvement as possible because, you know, the family can be such an important source of support for the patient.
Yeah, it doesn't seem as though this would be very easy to hide, too. You might be able to hide your depression or something, but your family is noticing that you're eating or not eating, that you're gaining weight.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. It's harder to hide, though you'd be surprised the way in which some people are able to do so. I mean, sometimes what you see happening is that the individual will dress in layers to kind of to hide their weight loss. Yeah. They may, you know, not all eating disorders have obvious physical manifestations. So, again, when you're talking about weight loss, certainly you would see that. But if you're talking about binging and purging behavior, an individual with bulimia nervosa may be underweight, they may be overweight, they may be normal weight. You may not be able to tell anything about their behavior based on their weight, so that it can go unnoticed.
I understand.
Is there... is there a specific reason that you found in over the years why someone, either male or female, goes to an eating disorder? You know, like, oh, they had broke up with their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, and you know, now they feel like they're too big, or they broke up because they were too heavy or whatever. I'm just using that as an example.
I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about what causes eating disorders, again, I don't think we have a really firm handle where we can say as a field, this is what causes eating disorders, definitely. We know that there's a strong biological component, and we know that there's some environmental pieces as well, but exactly in what proportion, how that all kind of plays out, we don't know entirely. We do know that dieting itself is a big risk factor. So what we see sometimes happen is people will point to some kind of event that prompted them to go on a diet, whether it's, you know, learning about something in a health class and, you know, being concerned about overweight in health classes, oh, let me go on a diet to try to lose some weight, or maybe the ending of a relationship prompted someone to go on a diet. Is that the cause per se? Probably not, because that triggered the dieting behavior, but what else was going on such that it, again, took on a life of its own? Most people can go on a diet or engage in those behaviors without developing an eating disorder. So there's more to it than that.
Well, I know mental illness... 9 times out of 10, there's a trigger that causes the person to go off. Now, it could be anything, you know. I know someone who was very, very successful in the business world, very high up, married, 3 kids, and one day he lost his pen, his best pen, and that was the trigger. Sent him off the edge. Now, it sounds like a little ludicrous, but that was his trigger. I'm not saying it wasn't other things, you know, involved, but that was the one that pushed him over. He couldn't find his favorite pen. Is there triggers that you find that, you know, I'm saying for everyone, but individually in, say, a small percentage of people that you treat, do they have a trigger that tripped them?
I mean, again, I think that there are different events that might precipitate it for somebody, whether, you know, it's, you know, a relationship or any number. I mean, there can be any number of things. Again, I wouldn't say that that's the cause, but that might be the event that kind of
pushed it along.
Set something in motion where they had an underlying biological vulnerability in the first place.
What happens if someone doesn't have a family? You know, you're saying that family is very important, and I agree, because it's very important with mental illness also. But there are people out there who have mental illness who don't have a family.
Very true. Yeah.
So I'm sure there's people who have an eating disorder who
yes.
don't have a family also.
Sure.
So how do you treat that, per se?
I mean, I think you work with the individual. I think you can also get creative about who might be included in a definition of family. Are there other social supports that the person has that might be able to be brought in? Friends, other okay. community members, clergy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What other supports are available to the individual? And there are folks who just don't have any social supports, and so then you're really working with the person one-on-one individually. But part of what I think we'd end up doing is trying to work with them around developing other sources of social support so
okay.
that, they have that, because we know that that's an important part of recovery, not just from an eating disorder, but from
right.
many, if not most things.
Right.
Social support can be such an important component.
This just popped into my head. All right, you've got someone that comes to you with a disorder, male, female, it doesn't matter. I mean, what is the treatment that you do then? What proceeds from that point on?
Well, it depends whether we're talking about inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment or anything in between.
What determines that? What determines inpatient as opposed to
outpatient? Yeah, that's a great question. So really it comes down to the severity of the symptoms and what level of care is needed for the person. So if they're a very low weight, they may need inpatient treatment in order to promote weight restoration. If they are engaging in binging and purging behavior so frequently that the person needs 24/7 monitoring in order to break that cycle, they may need inpatient treatment. If there are medical complications that require the person to be treated on an inpatient basis as well, electrolyte abnormalities, cardiac complications. So there's a number of things that might indicate that someone needs to be in the hospital. And then, intermediate levels of care from there.
Okay.
Though some patients can be treated on an outpatient basis. So it really varies depending
right.
on the severity of the illness that they're presenting.
I'm just curious, what kind of treatment person gets.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you feel that they have to be hospitalized. So now mm-hmm. they're in the hospital. And depending on, I guess they're all probably very thin at that point, I would think.
Not always. Again, they may, depending on the particular symptoms that they
okay.
are showing.
Then what treatment would proceed from there?
So in an inpatient setting, treatment would involve weight restoration, where meals are monitored and there's an expectation of, if they have weight to gain, there's an expectation of a certain minimum amount of
okay.
weight gain per week. If weight gain is not expected, again, for a patient struggling with bulimia or other types
uh-huh.
of eating disorders, normalization of eating would be the goal, so that they're eating from a variety of different food groups according
okay.
to a regular schedule, again, normalizing their eating. So whatever the case, at an inpatient level of care, nutritional rehabilitation is going to be a very important component.
Okay.
Treatment of any medical complications that the person has as well. So you see a lot of GI complications with eating disorders. Again, you see cardiac complications sometimes. So treatment of anything else that might be going on with the individual, either as a result of or not necessarily an outgrowth of the eating disorder, but maybe related
uh-huh.
to it in some way, or just independent,
right.
any medical
right.
complication, any medical issues that might be occurring. And then intensive psychotherapy. We do extensive group therapies. We have a pretty full
mm-hmm.
group therapy schedule over the course of the day. We also do intensive individual therapy or family therapy.
Okay.
So really treatment designed to look at all of the different aspects of the problem. Again, the biological, the nutritional, the psychological, the social.
Robin's raising her hand over there. You're not in school, Robin. You can just talk.
Right. Because I would like to paint a picture of what that unit looks like for the listeners, because it's not a regular hospital unit, although
really
it is
point.
In a med-surg hospital. Dr. Parisi Cummings has been involved with this when it used to be
uh-huh.
an old pediatric unit like you see in any med-surg hospital
right.
with
right.
just two per room and the cloth in the middle. She helped design an environment that is also enriching to the patient experience. So all the patients, when they're about 12 and older, can have their own room. They bring in their own comforter. They make the bedroom their own.
There's actually two doubles on the unit, but most of our patients have singles, yes.
And for the what age bracket for the...
It depends. It just depends on the particulars, what the individual's needs are, what the unit's needs are.
And all the rooms have picture windows so that you can look out and look at the environment, because we do evidence-based research that the more that you can see your environment and be in sunshine and all of those sort of things play into it. And when they go off for the groups that Mindy talks about, they're beautifully appointed group rooms. It's not like they're a little circle in a little corner of a community room or something. And a full kitchen area that they utilize and do family work with there. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's really a beautiful space.
Okay. Does the patient have like a caseworker, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, every patient has a primary treatment team that includes an attending psychiatrist, a primary therapist who's a licensed social worker or a licensed professional counselor or licensed marriage and family therapist, and they also have a primary dietitian. So those three individuals will be working with that patient very closely throughout their treatment.
And how long is normally a normal, quote-unquote, treatment?
It really varies. Our average length of stay is about 30-plus days. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 31 or 32 days right now. It may be a little bit higher even now. But that, that's an average doesn't tell you a whole lot about any individual.
Right,
so
right.
It could be, it could range from a week on perhaps the lower end to several weeks, even months on for some of our folks who are more severely medically compromised, have a lot of weight to gain, things like that. So it's a big range.
Right.
I have a question about that, the people who are severely compromised. Is the food served? Is it served in their individual room, or are they in a group setting? Or
Our patients eat together in a communal, in a community group setting. So, and that's by design. They can kind of help to motivate each other. There's sort of this sense that kind of we're all in this together, and peer pressure, if you will, to eat normally.
Is there a... I know with mental illness there's a stigma. I mean, people like to say there isn't, but there is. Mm-hmm. And part of NAMI's thing is to try to break that. Is there a stigma associated with eating disorders?
I think there is a stigma associated with eating disorders, and I think there's also a lack of understanding about eating disorders, not just a stigma.
Yeah, that too.
I think there tends to eating disorders are a little strange in that there is, at the same time that there's a stigma, I think there's also some glamorization of eating disorders.
Okay.
So you see that sometimes in the media, so-and-so has this eating disorder, and it's hard to explain, but I think we do see that sometimes. Or I see it sometimes even in I'll give you an example. I was doing a talk at a hotel, a conference center in central New Jersey just last week. And there was, the sign and table for our talk was in one place, and then there was another meeting completely unrelated going on in another part of the hotel, and people kept coming up to our table for their meeting, and they said, no, this is eating disorders. Oh, I wish I had one of those. And we heard that over and over again. Oh, I need some of that. Like, it's this thing, like, it's this perception is that it's a great way to lose weight, or people who have eating disorders are successful at weight loss, which is so hard for other people, or they have willpower, or I just want a little bit of that. And it's not like that at all.
Right,
it's actually
a
devastating, serious mental illness
that
I would not wish on anybody.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't wish any mental illness on anybody,
exactly.
But,
very true.
Including my son who has it. But
it's a strange thing. Like, I don't think there's any other disorder where you'd say, I wish I had that.
I wish I had
a little bit of that.
Right, right.
Could I have a little bit of depression, or could I have a little bit of schizophrenia?
Yeah,
it doesn't make a lot. So that's what I mean when I say there's...
At the same time that
there's stigma, there's also some glamorization of that. At the same time, though, I think you're absolutely right. There is significant stigma associated with it. And I think that's especially true for males who have eating disorders, because eating disorders tend to be associated more with girls and women. So I think for people who have a gender atypical illness, there is an even greater sense of stigma.
With the anorexia, just in terms of the progress of the illness, do people just wildly fluctuate in weight? I remember my freshman year in college seeing this one woman just gain 100 pounds, and then a few months later she was way down. And is that common?
I think you can see fluctuations in weight, especially when the person is in a refeeding stage or, you know, a treatment stage. There's unfortunately a lot of relapse associated with eating disorders, so folks may gain weight in a treatment setting and then relapse and lose the weight again, and so you may see that kind of back and forth. Mm-hmm. Patients who have bulimia nervosa, you may see large weight fluctuations as a result of kind of the kind of chaotic eating patterns, that kind of thing.
Well, I lost 160 pounds, and in order to do that, I had to get my knees replaced, and I wouldn't do it until I lost weight. So I lost 160 pounds, and now I do this, you know, up and down, up and down, up and down. But it stays within like 5 to 6 pounds, but it's up and down. As you can see, my chest is now over my belt, you know. But what are you going to do? But do you find that people go through your treatment and are stable for a period and then relapse?
That can happen sometimes. I've seen a number of folks who have a period of stability, you know, a good period of stability in their lives. And then, you know, you mentioned there being a trigger. Something happens that kind of sets them down that road of dieting or engaging in symptoms as a way of coping again, and it kind of comes back. So that can definitely happen. The good news in those cases, though, is they have had the experience of successful treatment. They have had the experience of a period of recovery or remission, so you're not always starting at square one, which I think is important.
Do medications play any part in the treatment?
You know, that's a great question. It's a complicated question. In the acute phase of the illness, especially, well, for anorexia nervosa, for example, there is no medication that's approved for the FDA approved for the treatment of anorexia. And at that stage, when someone is very chronically malnourished, is medication even going to be helpful at that point? Or is there the things that we see going on with, you know, maybe depressed mood or, you know, mood lability, is that an underlying mood disorder, or is that simply an effect of starvation that will resolve with better nutrition? Now, for bulimia nervosa, SSRIs are sometimes used, and they have been have had some success with that. Prozac is approved for the use of for use in patients with bulimia. Now, that said, and then with binge eating disorder, actually, there are also some approved medications. Mm-hmm. That said, though, when you have, we talked about comorbid psychiatric or mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, where someone had, you know, something else going on, a mood disorder, anxiety disorders, thing like that. And if, particularly if that preceded the eating disorder, then there may be more of a role for medication. But it can be difficult to kind of tease that apart. Again, what's the result of starvation versus what's something that would be treated effectively with medication. But we do see medications.
Okay, so my other question is, do you use intravenous feeding at all, or is that just for the very acute stages when someone's life-threatened?
So it's we always try to work with the person to eat normally by mouth using regular food. If all of our interventions around that if the disorder is resistant to those particular interventions, we may get to a point where we have to use a nasal gastric tube feeding or occasionally TPN, or, you know, where the feeding is done through you know, through the bloodstream, but that's rare. It's generally not preferable.
I can understand. Sure.
Yeah.
Because that's.
But an NG tube, for example, might be more common.
Okay.
Again, though, preference is to do it to do refeeding through regular food, oral, you know, by mouth. As much as possible.
Right. Now, I would think that you must have to weigh someone daily, or how often?
Correct.
So is that sort of a traumatic experience for people maybe I didn't gain, maybe I did? Or
well, we'll weigh our patients every day, but our patients aren't necessarily told their weight every day.
Right.
So
they don't even know.
They're blind weighed, so know their weight, but they don't necessarily know their weight. And we'll talk about it as a treatment team, how often they should know their weight or when they should know their weight. I think it's important that they do ultimately know their weight, because even if they don't know when they're in treatment, eventually they're going to leave our care, and that hasn't been discussed with them.
Right.
Yeah. I don't like surprises.
I agree.
I'd much rather have that conversation while they're able to work with us around that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But how often that happens is, you know, really individualized.
Yeah, I can see why it would be a good thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, if they're not told every single time, that would just lessen the pressure on them.
Yeah, because if that's the case, then all of the discussion tends to be around weight and numbers all the time. Uh-huh. So we want to be able to, look at the whole picture.
Right. I think if you don't, then the first thing you're going to do is go out and get a scale
Right, and that's the other side of that.
Right.
You don't ever test it. It's
really
about finding the balance.
Finding the balance, exactly.
No pun intended.
Now, no, none taken. Is there I assume you're treating an individual, so that may be different, but is the treatment pretty much the same for males and females?
They're very similar. The way in which eating disorders present themselves are very similar for males and females, with some minor subtleties. So males with eating disorders tend to have been overweight more often than women with eating disorders. So that may be something that needs to be addressed in treatment. Anybody with an eating disorder, there may be a strong exercise component, but that tends to be an important piece for males, that may be the biggest kind of the way in which the weight loss is accomplished. And you mentioned in the young man that you talk about, doing many sit-ups. So you see that often in males and for that reason, the eating disorder may go undetected at first, because it just looks like the person is engaging in a lot of exercise, which is very socially sanctioned. It's seen as desirable, pursuing athleticism. So it becomes a way of overlooking. So that exercise piece will often need to be addressed. Other treatment considerations for males, I think, I think you have to address the stigma, the potential for stigma. Do they come into this with a different sense of stigma around having a gender atypical illness? So I think that's an important piece. And I think another is that males in general are not as socialized to talk about their feelings as girls and women are. So I think
that's true.
So I think it can be very daunting for a male to come into treatment and come into a group and be expected to just start talking about their feelings.
Right.
So I think we have to, kind of work with men around. There's other way. What other? How else can they express themselves, and kind of having patience for that process?
Right.
That may not come naturally to them, but also kind of giving them permission to talk about their feelings and their experience, giving them permission to share feelings of vulnerability. That may be the first time that someone's ever kind of done that in that setting. So
I know over the last 20 years I've been involved with NAMI and mental health, I find that a lot of males, they can fight through it themselves.
Exactly.
They don't need help.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately, you do need help, but getting them to understand that is a major mountain to cross, and a lot of times it takes a long time for that to penetrate. It may be 3, 4, 5 collapses before, it strikes, the light bulb goes on,
It's okay to ask for help.
Right.
It's okay to be vulnerable.
It's okay to be human,
Absolutely.
It's
okay to be sad or hurt.
Right. It's that mentality that I think, is instilled over years and years and years, that hurts if they have a problem. Mm-hmm. They can't bring it out,
So I think clinicians need to be sensitive to that and kind of help boys and men develop a language for feelings that may not that may not come naturally
to
them.
Absolutely.
Also some really kind of, it sounds unimportant, but I think I think it is important, just treatment considerations, just even in terms of decor, a treatment center. Again, because it tends to be associated with women, you see a lot of, I've heard of a lot of boys and men talking about another treatment center with like the pink butterflies on the wall, just to be sensitive to
right.
you know, men right. coming in. So, you know, like our program's very, I think, would you describe it as pretty gender neutral?
Gender neutral, exactly.
You know? So just that kind of thing, like the decor, what kinds of community activities are. Mm-hmm. So are there, if there's one lounge with one TV, what kinds of programs are on TV? And I've had guys in the program saying, nobody wants to watch football here.
Yeah, right.
And that becomes a thing, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Like, I don't want to watch Grey's Anatomy or whatever, you know.
Or Days of Our Lives or something, you know.
Yeah. So things like that. Use of pronouns in the promotional literature for the program. So a lot of female pronouns are used, but trying to be more gender inclusive and that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I think those are all important pieces.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. So in terms of decor, I guess you're not putting red in the... I know that stimulates the appetite. Have you gone that far?
No, we haven't. I think our colors are mostly blues and greens and
calming,
orange.
Soothing.
Calming and soothing, yeah. Kind of nature-inspired colors, I would say.
We have about 4 more minutes. Is there anything we haven't touched that you would like to bring up?
You know, I think one of the things that's really important to talk about is, you know, while treatment can be difficult and these are life-threatening illnesses, I think the bottom line is that people can and do get well from eating disorders, especially with treatment. You know, regardless of whether, you know, a person's male or female, the faster a person can be diagnosed and get into treatment, you know, appropriately aggressive treatment, the faster they're able to kind of normalize weight and eating, as well as all the other things that go along with an eating disorder, the better are the chances for recovery. So people can and do get well. So I want to make sure
Right. Absolutely.
There is hope.
Yeah.
Doesn't
absolutely.
Hope.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It doesn't have to be quite as much of a lifetime burden as some of the other mental disorders, really.
Yeah, I think for some people it is a lifetime thing, but I think for another subset of people really can and do have full recoveries from eating disorders. Mm-hmm. So,
wow, that's pretty interesting.
Do you or your organization and the hospital take insurance and Medicare and all that jazz?
We do. We take most insurances.
Okay.
Medicaid, Medicare.
Okay. The other thing is, if someone wanted to reach out to you for either an appointment or more information, how would they do that?
So to make an appointment for an evaluation or to you know, consider that for any more information, they could contact our admissions department.
Okay.
And that number is 609-853-7575.
I'm impressed. You didn't even look it up.
Right.
You didn't even look on your paper for that. I'm impressed.
Yes, I am. And let's repeat that a little slower, too, in case anybody wants to write it down.
You know, Mindy mentioned so many different variances of the eating disorder and bulimia and anorexia. And the person making the call doesn't have to be the person who says,
absolutely.
Oh, I know that I need this.
Right.
Because quite often they're the loved ones of the person with the...
with the illness.
And with the illness. So there's an easy number, and the people that answer the phone are the clinicians that help the family tease out. Like Mindy was saying, it might look like an anxiety disorder. And so as you're doing the intake, all of a sudden you find out, well, the person's only 85 pounds.
Right.
It's like, ooh, well, then maybe let's look at something else. And that number is 888-437-1610. And that is all of the Princeton House behavioral health options. So the person might be talking about anxiety, and really you see it's trauma. So where you think you might be calling because it's eating disorders, it might be the trigger because of the trauma, and they really need trauma work.
Okay.
Again, the caller doesn't have to worry about that. Let the professionals help tease that out.
Why don't you give that number again?
It's 888-437-1610. And that's for the eating disorders and the outpatient services. I'd like to give you one more number for our inpatient.
Sure, go ahead.
And that is 800-242-2550. And that would be our first responders treatment program, our behavioral health, the psychiatric, mm-hmm. and then our addiction disorder program yeah. inpatient.
Well, I can't thank you folks enough for coming. I really appreciate it. And it's been very informative. And I hope that you feel that you've accomplished something in getting the word out to people, because I think you have. And Robin, it's always a pleasure to see you.
My pleasure, Larry. You know,
and Dr. Mindy Parisi Cummings.
Yes.
Ah, okay, I got it. Thank you so much for coming
thank
in.
Thank you here. So much for having me. Appreciate
we really
it.
Appreciate
keep
it.
Keep up the good work.
And remember, hey, folks, mental health does matter. See you next week.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program. No drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
Come join us for the 4th Annual Hunterdon County Community Day on Saturday, June 3rd from 11 to 4 at the County Fairgrounds, South County Park in Ringo's. There'll be food, there'll be music, there'll be games, fun for the whole family, pony rides and a petting zoo, reptile shows by Michael Schwedick, outdoor games and activities, a shred event sponsored by the Hunterdon County Clerk from 11 to 3, tethered balloon rides by Unity Bank. The 4th Annual Hunterdon County Community Day on Saturday, June 3rd, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the Board of Chosen Freeholders of Hunterdon County, Hunterdon Healthcare, Unity Bank, Jersey Mike's and Subs. For all the great details and information, visit HunterdonChamber.org or give us a call at 908-782-7115.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
This is Tony Clark, paraplanner at Patton, Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Pat and Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Pat and Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters of Weikert Realtors. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime. And selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 and Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own. Then, I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process through technology to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a smooth